Hello everyone and welcome back to the Damage Report, but this is not just a regular Damage Report, it is of course Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving to all of you watching this. Hopefully you're doing this like at some point early on in the day and then going and doing family stuff, because that's what I'm gonna be doing today. I'm not actually here, but we did wanna give you something interesting for this holiday. And so what we've decided to do is, I wanted to take a look back at the year. We've gone through most of 2019 at this point, and I thought it would be nice to take a little bit of time to take stock of some of the material that we've covered, some of the really interesting people that we've talked to. And so in this episode and the episode that'll be coming tomorrow, our Black Friday episode, we're gonna be taking you through a tour of some of the best of the Damage Report in 2019. Not necessarily quality-wise, but what we're going for in doing this show. And so in this episode, we're gonna be showing you some of my favorite interviews from throughout the year. To give you an idea of the sorts of people that we're trying to talk to, the sorts of perspectives we're trying to bring to you every day. And we're gonna be starting off with the interview I did a little bit earlier this year with University of Michigan professor David Dunning. I brought him on to talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect, named after him, because one of the goals that I had for the show early on was that I wanted to expose people to psychological principles, political psychological principles, so that then they could analyze the behavior and activity of politicians and voters and learn a little bit from it. The Dunning-Kruger effect is a really interesting one that is very applicable to our president and honestly a lot of other politicians. And so here is that interview. The Dunning-Kruger effect, it is complex. People are just starting to learn about it and in some cases taking sort of the wrong idea from it in how they apply it to politics. So what does it actually mean based on your research?
Well, the Dunning-Kruger effect, if you boil it down to its most basic form, is simply the observation that incompetent people or people who aren't experts don't know they aren't experts, or scratch that, they actually can't know they're experts, or they can't know the shortcomings or the incompetencies that they may possess. That's what it is in its short form. The key in the way in which people tend to get it wrong is they tend to think that this is a phenomenon that basically inflicts other people and it's all about them and how they get it wrong. But actually, the key thing to keep in mind is this is a phenomenon that sooner or later hits all of us. It's really about us and our own incompetencies and our own shortcomings.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I, as a person with a lot of pride in myself, would like to assume that it only happens to other people, but I do want to be more cognizant of it. And so that's why in a little bit we will talk about some ways to try to be aware of this and what you can do to sort of circumvent it. In terms of politics, though, it is most often invoked in my experience and by me in reference to Donald Trump. So what is it about Donald Trump that makes it that people want to use this concept to explain his communication style and his appeal?
Well, if you observe Donald Trump over any period of time, what you realize is he likes to boast that he knows more than other people. He knows more about war than his generals. He knows more about the economy than the economists that are advising him. He knows more about X than the X people who have got degrees in whatever X is. And I don't think such a person really exists. The person who's more expert than everybody else in everything just can't possibly be. That suggests that maybe there are some shortcomings he's not aware of.
I think that is probably the case. I think it's somewhat complicated with him because I think that there's also a healthy dose of brand building that whether he actually believes that he's an expert on nuclear weapons technology, he definitely wants you to think that he's an expert on that. But zooming out from Donald Trump, why is it that we as people have so much trouble acknowledging and understanding our limitations in particular areas?
The reason we have trouble is because of a paradox, which is that to spot expertise in other people, obviously, you need expertise in yourself. But that's also true for spotting lack of expertise. That is, to be able to tell when a person has a shortcoming or to tell when a person might be getting something wrong, well, you need the expertise to be able to judge that, the true expertise to judge that. Now, if you lack that expertise, it means that you lack the very knowledge you need in order to identify shortcomings. And that's true not only in judgments of other people, but it's also true of the self. So ultimately what that means is people who lack knowledge lack the knowledge to realize they lack the knowledge.
If people don't understand that this is even necessarily a thing that exists, how do we try to get people to understand and recognize? Like, how do you get past this problem if people don't even know that it is a problem to get past?
Well, what you need to do is you need to do something perhaps that is done in medicine, which is called a competency challenge. That is, you give people a test or you give people a task to do, ask them how well they think they're doing on it, and then you show them how well they're actually doing on it. Mm-hmm. And often what you find is people can very easily recognize all of a sudden at that moment what they don't know. So, for example, one common exercise that can be done in the laboratory is if you ask people how a helicopter works or how a ballpoint pen works, they'll go, yeah, sure, I absolutely know how that works. And then you say, okay, show me. Mm-hmm. And in detail, how a helicopter works. And also, by the way, include the detail about how a helicopter moves forward and backward. And people suddenly realize there are holes in their knowledge that they weren't aware of before. So there are things that you can do, but one of the things that you can do for yourself is often if a question is important enough, do spend some time thinking about how you might be wrong. You begin to realize cautions or questions that you wouldn't have been otherwise aware of.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so it's a complex process, but I think that people can take from that at least the beginning steps of dealing with this. It seems like one of the things that you gain through experience in a topic is factual knowledge about it. Particularly in politics, people seem to have a difficulty in differentiating between opinions that they hold strongly and things that are objectively true. Which might be another psychological problem with humanity that's sort of inherent to it. Is that a part of this problem, that people have a difficulty in understanding what is and is not actually a fact?
I think that is part of it, because you can't know that you're factually wrong if you have a hard time identifying what a fact is. And in fact, what we find in our own work is that if you ask Democrats or Republicans factual questions, not only opinion questions, but factual questions, they'll differ quite wildly in terms of what they construe as facts in the ground when it comes to economics, politics, or the social scene in America. So, for example, during the Obama administration, a majority of Republicans will say the stock market went down, a majority of Democrats will say it went up. What happened to the poverty rate the first 2 years of the Obama administration? Republicans will say it went up, Democrats will say it went down. Now, the truth for one of those questions favors the Democrats. The truth for the other question favors Republicans. But Republicans and Democrats tend to come to factual beliefs that only favor themselves.
Yeah, and I've actually taken a couple of those sorts of online tests about basic historical knowledge, and when you get the results and realize how you've been wrong, that's a humbling experience. Mm. It makes you realize what a walking primate you are, I guess, that we still have these issues. So I want to ask you another question. I assume a little bit of this is going to be probably not as grounded in your research, but I am curious about some of the implications. I wonder, politicians and members of the media, consciously or unconsciously, I wonder if people in positions of authority and influence are becoming a little bit more savvy about exploiting some of these psychological issues and gaps to advance their agenda, whether political or a narrative that they're pushing. Do you feel that might be accurate?
Well, I think experts in dealing with people have always been somewhat aware of this. Remember, P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there is ignorance that can be exploited is something that has been known since time immemorial. I think with the internet and with the high speed and the high availability of news, it's just much more visible. Mm-hmm. That is, we see a lot of other people falling prey to it. The only question is we don't see ourselves falling prey to it, and that's the next step that we have to achieve somehow.
Okay, I'm going to work on that in advance of our eventual second conversation. Dr. Dunning, thank you so much for joining us. I've been wanting to talk to you about your research for quite some time, so thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Also, as a quick aside, I just want to say, people love to talk about a hypothetical, if I was able to go back in time, 500 years, oh my God, with my modern knowledge, I could be king, I could rule all, I'd be able to invent all these technologies and everything. I don't think so. I couldn't make anything. A microwave is effectively magic to me. He brought up helicopters and ballpoint pens. If you gave me 10 years, I could not make a ballpoint pen for myself. So I think we should have a little bit of humility, even in fictional time travel scenarios.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Tucker Carlson has been doing two different kinds of rebranding at the same time. The substantive sort of rebranding is that every year his show is more explicitly meant to appeal to white nationalists. He pushes their narratives, he brings on their guests, he talks about their literature and all of that. But he does want to cloak that. And so he is trying to build up this aura of him being some sort of reasonable populist throughout this year. And it has actually tricked some people. Earlier this year, I got to talk with Parker Malloy of Media Matters, who came on after doing quite a bit of analysis on her own right of Tucker Carlson's attempt to appeal to a new audience. Here's that interview. You basically wrote that he is a master at the art of misdirection. Could you explain your thesis for our audience?
Sure, sure. So one of the things that I've kind of noticed is so Tucker Carlson on the show, a lot of times he will talk about the ruling class. He likes to blame things on the ruling class, which is fair. You know, we do have a ruling class, as all societies do, but he never elaborates on what he really means by that. So a few weeks ago, I started reading his book, which talks about how the ruling class is destroying America, basically. And he doesn't get into it there so much either. So I started watching clip after clip after clip of his show, especially the ones where he will say something that progressives will kind of nod our heads to, thinking, yes, this makes sense. And you see sometimes he'll get he'll get praised, like what was it, Vox wrote something. Vox had a story that said, last Wednesday, the conservative talk show host started a fire on the right after airing a prolonged monologue on a show that was, in essence, an indictment of American capitalism. Now, that sounds progressive. That sounds kind of awesome. And if you listen to what he's saying, it sometimes can sound that way, the way he'll talk about taxes or the way he'll talk about Amazon, for instance. But One thing I always find when I watch these segments is they'll start out talking about something like that, a real problem in the world, like why is the tax code so complex, or why do tech companies like Facebook continue to pump out products that they know are potentially harmful and are addictive by design. And so he'll make these good points, but then he'll come to some sort of really bonkers conclusion. He'll talk about how the suicide rate for men is too high, and then he'll end with the conclusion that women should not be in the workplace or something like that, where it's just like so disconnected and you're like, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. And so that's what this article tries to do. It tries to break down how he gets there. And essentially, I kind of liken it to rhetorical sleight of hand. So basically what he does is he'll say something that will get people on board, and then he'll just sort of pivot. And he uses this concept of the ruling class as his pivot point, where he'll argue that this ruling class is trying to appease identity-based groups. So mm-hmm. what he likes to do is he likes to then basically pivot and blame problems like stagnant wages on gay people, or, you know, unemployment, you know, only partial employment. He'll blame that on companies that are trying to appease trans people or people of color, or that care about diversity. You know, he refers to this as a diversity cult. But at the same time, he contradicts himself constantly. You know, in his book, he talks about how, you know, if you wanted to run a country for the benefit of everyone, you would de-emphasize differences between us. And he'll point to the left to say that we tend to emphasize those differences, and that's what's dividing us. But then later in the book, he'll make the same argument, saying that people trying to argue that men are the same as women, or that have the same capabilities and in interests and stuff like that, that those people just aren't living in reality. So he'll say these two things that are at their face contradictory, but it's all in the service of getting to his kind of fringy conclusions, which, if he starts off that way, people like you and me, we won't tune into it. We're not likely to tune into something if he just starts off and says, "So, how about white supremacy?" and just like dives in like with a pro white supremacy message. So he has to kind of lure us in with these little bits, these little you know, criticizing Amazon or talking about how the tax system is too complicated, or that, you know, we don't care about the poor, you know, these things like that, workers' conditions. He talks about workers' conditions in his book, which is kind of amazing because that doesn't match up with his actual politics. But he talks about these things as actual problems, and they are. He just always comes to these conclusions that are far-fetched, to say, you know, at best.
Yeah, and that the policy implications are the same as any Republican politician would come up with. And in the end, the groups that he blames are the same that Sean Hannity would, or that the Five would in those same situations. He just helps to muddle what a ruling class in theory would actually be. I love that, like, who is the ruling class? Gay interests, obviously, clearly. He says journalists too. He'll attack Amazon because he doesn't like the particular politics that he thinks the person who owns it has. So here's something. I mean, he talks about journalists. You sort of get into this in your piece. In what possible world is, with the vague definitions that he has applied to this ruling class, is he not a part of it?
Right. That I kind of, especially because one of the things he says in his book is he talks about how Mark Zuckerberg cannot be, you know, he's detached from the world, and he can't understand what it's like because he's always grown up in this sort of bubble. And how has Tucker Carlson not? Tucker Carlson was born into a well-off family that then became an extremely wealthy family. So his experience is just as shielded as Mark Zuckerberg's. You know, he takes jabs at Zuckerberg. I think the way he frames it is in some like vaguely anti-Semitic kind of way. That's where he talks about orthodontists, the children of orthodontists, and stuff like that, which is just, I don't know. There are all these like tiny dog whistles in his in both his book and on his show, obviously. So he does that, and he uses that as a disqualifier for, you know, clearly Zuckerberg doesn't know what's going on because of how he was raised, because he was shielded from real life implications and real life struggles. But Tucker Carlson is the exact same way. He is just as shielded. He grew up and didn't really ever have you know, didn't really struggle. He was born into a family that had some great ties in media. You know, his stepmother is the heiress to the Swanson frozen food empire, I guess. So there's money, there's connections. He's got it all. And I think what kind of scared me about all of this, not scared me so much as just kind of intrigued me, because as you sort of said, he's not like Sean Hannity. He is not like, you know, he's not like the Five, but he comes to the same conclusions.
Yeah.
And I think the difference there is that Tucker Carlson's very smart, and that's what makes him very effective. You know, I kind of see Hannity as this sort of oafish character, whereas Carlson, you know, if he wanted to, I think he could be an extremely successful politician in terms of getting people on board, because what he says, everything comes off as this sort of Rorschach kind of test where you'll hear what you want to hear, which is the same exact thing that you saw with Donald Trump when he was running. You know, you saw people who they were against immigration, and they saw his policies as being against immigration. Mm-hmm. And whereas, you know, then you see people who are more liberal or progressive, they'll see things like, well, he held up a gay pride flag once, so clearly he cares about this group. And so it's this thing where you throw out so much information that people can cherry pick what they want to justify siding with you. And I think that that's one thing that Tucker Carlson does really, really well. And, you know, if he wasn't raking in so much money on TV and didn't have this, you know, decades long history of being on TV, you know, if he just kind of popped up out of nowhere and had these politics and had this rhetorical style, I think that he could be an extremely successful politician. I don't think that would be a good thing personally. Mm. But at the same time, you know, it's very fascinating. You know, there are some people I think that you can kind of take shots at their intelligence. But when it comes to Tucker Carlson, I think he's an extremely smart man.
Do you remember the big fight over Brett Kavanaugh getting onto the Supreme Court? It was this huge media event, and he eventually did get on. But even as that was happening, we all said, we're not going to forget about this. We are going to continue to put pressure on him, considering all that we found out about his history. Unfortunately, that didn't really happen, even as earlier this year, more information about his past came out. Well, I am not interested in simply jettisoning that entire topic as something of importance. And so I brought on actress and activist Piper Perabo, who had been around initially in the fight against Kavanaugh, to talk about the newest information about him. Let's take a look. We talked last, right around the time of his confirmation hearings. You had been arrested, dragged out of the hearings. And so I'm curious, how do you feel about the scrutiny once again being placed on his record?
I'm happy about it. I think that there wasn't a thorough FBI investigation the first time around, and this is what happens when we don't do our jobs properly, then we have to go back and fix it all. So I'm glad that there are people calling for an investigation and an impeachment inquiry. I think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah. So I mean, we're sort of fast forwarding quite a bit from the last conversation that we had. And I mean, I remember thinking after, you know, the hours of testimony and then Susan Collins' speech, when he got on, I thought, you know what? Please, let's hope that this does not simply become normalized, that people will pay attention to it. And largely, it seems like that didn't happen. I'm curious, at the time, did you think that by this point there would have been a more serious reckoning for Brett Kavanaugh?
I mean, I was so heartbroken after the Susan Collins speech when she said she would vote to confirm him. And she said in her speech that she thought by voting to confirm him, it would, you know, bring people together and unite the judiciary. And I don't think that's happened. I didn't really know what was going to happen. I feel like we don't have a process in place for this when there are allegations of wrongdoing brought against a judicial nominee, especially in the Supreme Court. And so one of the good things about having an FBI investigation into this, whatever the result, is that maybe we could have some guidelines so that we don't have to do this kind of make it up as we go along version the next time something comes up.
Yeah. And so, look, I know that you've been doing research on the impeachment process, and a number of presidential candidates on the Democratic side now support his impeachment, or at least an investigation that could lead to his impeachment. Now, some people respond to that by saying, might be divisive, similar to when they talk about impeaching Donald Trump, that it could hypothetically hurt the Democrats in 2020. What do you think about that concern?
I disagree with that concern. I think that you don't run a government based on what might happen to a candidate in the future. You stand up for what you believe in. You make sure that we have lawful process and people have confidence in the justice system, and you stand up for values like telling the truth. And when people come forward with allegations of wrongdoing, we trust that our law enforcement agencies will investigate that. Whatever, you know, people say, oh, you don't want to go for impeachment because of Kavanaugh or Trump, because McConnell will never let it come to the floor for a vote. But what McConnell does is up to him. I elected my representatives to be a voice for me in this government, and I think we should investigate allegations of wrongdoing.
Exactly, yeah. I sort of get, I guess, why people would say, well, if it can't get to where we need it to be, why go along that path at all? But I feel like, first of all, our elected representatives have a constitutional responsibility. They can't necessarily assure the outcome, but they can assure the process. And also, I worry so much about setting a precedent where if the Republicans, especially thanks to the way the system is set up that benefits them in places like the Senate, that there will just be no consequences whatsoever.
Yeah, and I want to see people on the record. You know, if we get to, if we could actually get to a, you know, if allegations are found to be factual and we get to a place where we're having a vote for impeachment on the Senate floor, I want everyone's vote to be known. I want you to be on the record for how you're dealing with this and not, you just don't get a pass because we're too afraid to look at the truth.
You've been involved in this since the very beginning, fighting for scrutiny and perhaps consequences for Brett Kavanaugh. Some on the right, they respond by saying, oh, you guys, you're just, you would say that about any nominee. You guys are gonna somehow conjure, you know, several dozen women with allegations of sexual assault, no matter who it is. What do you think about that argument that the right is pushing?
I mean, I didn't go in and interrupt the nomination of Gorsuch.
That's a good point.
You know, I had a lot of angry feelings about that because I felt like Merrick Garland was denied his seat on the court and then they bring in Gorsuch. But I wasn't, there weren't women coming forward alleging him of wrongdoings. We were unhappy about it, and that's not the nominee I would have liked, but you didn't see women protesting and people coming forward with allegations of sexual assault.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you would expect that that was only a couple of years ago. People should be able to remember that. Not to mention the fact that, of course, George W. Bush got two people on the Supreme Court. The Democrats weren't inventing sexual assaults back then either. But that sort of gets us into, oh, did you have something you want to say?
I was going to say also, like, when you're talking about people coming forward and victims of sexual assault, I mean, that the default answer is like, oh, you're just doing that for political reasons. Part of this whole like Me Too movement is believing survivors to the point that you at least investigate what they say. No one's saying that someone says something and so you trash somebody's career, but someone brings up an allegation of a crime and you investigate it. That's
exactly
what we're asking for.
Yeah, exactly. And the claims that some of these women are doing it, they're just doing it for self-interested reasons. Yeah, like with hindsight, we can totally say that Christine Blasey Ford, she's really benefited from being dragged through the national media. This has been a big winner for her in terms of publicity and money. I mean, it's just absurd.
I mean, she has nothing to gain, which is obvious from the result. And this woman that Max Steyer, the claims that came out in the New York Times over the weekend that Max Steyer brought up and the woman who says she doesn't remember, I mean, part of me thinks, of course you don't remember. Why would you say anything about this after what you've seen happen to Christine Blasey Ford?
Yeah, let alone the fact that she might have blocked the memory. That is that's often a thing that happened. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But again, an investigation would get to that. But they don't,
exactly.
They don't want that. And so that's the last point that I want to touch on is the arguments that we've seen whenever virtually anyone makes a claim of a sexual assault or sexual harassment against a powerful person. It feels like the right feels very emboldened to simply say, it doesn't matter how many women you have. A woman saying something happened means literally nothing. It counts for nothing. And so what do you think about, if you agree, I don't want to speak for you, but the precedent being set where a woman's testimony is effectively not important?
Well, I mean, that's what's happened with this case. And I just feel like as a woman who's watching my government and my judicial system, part of why I don't like this president is because women have come forward with claims of sexual assault over and over again. And it's starting to feel like feels like our voices don't matter. Our allegations aren't listened to. Our bodies aren't safe. That's why I stood up. It's really hard to continue to be silent.
Of course.
So,
of course, and especially considering that for any woman, but especially a woman very much in the public eye, to do so means that you will be attacked constantly. I appreciate you doing that, Piper. We are now in the thick of this impeachment inquiry. It's now a public thing that everyone's paying attention to, and things have certainly moved fast, I should say. But I would like to take a look back at the beginning of this scandal, when surprisingly impeachment was finally on the table. At that time, I was joined by investigative journalist David K. Johnston to break down how seriously Donald Trump should be taking this scandal and what our expectations at the time of the process were. Let's watch. So things have been developing fast, even this morning. We've talked previously about how Donald Trump reacts under pressure, under investigations. You've been watching as things have been developing. What are your initial impressions to how this story has played out?
Well, there's an enormous amount going on. It's almost impossible to keep track of all of it at the moment. But fundamentally, what's happened here is the dam has broken. Donald Trump had built this dam of secrecy, this wall of secrecy. It's now been breached in a significant way. And of course, it isn't tearing babies from their mother's arms. It isn't pouring pollutants into the air and the water or any of the other things Trump has done. It's national security that suddenly has gotten Washington's attention. And Donald is behaving in a frantic manner. He knows that he's in trouble over this. And he's desperately trying to figure out how to discredit everybody, which is what's worked for him in the past.
Yeah. And look, even beyond discrediting, we had the audio yesterday of him talking about either the whistleblower or whoever might have provided information to the whistleblower should be dealt with like we used to deal with spies or something right to that effect. What do you think about this turn for Trump?
Well, Donald, you know, is not very smart. He's not educated. And he pulls things up out of his hat. And he clearly has these violence fantasies. You know, he's talked about wiping out all 25 million people in North Korea. He's talked about wiping out everybody who lives in Afghanistan. And so it's kind of not surprising, at least to me, that, you know, he wants to go back to the idea of hanging spies in wartime when they're caught summarily. What's bizarre about this is the whistleblower, whose identity we're going to learn pretty soon, he or she is going to testify. The whistleblower very clearly was someone who was being informed by people right around Donald. They probably didn't know this was coming, but you can see how openly information flows behind that wall about what Trump is doing and how little we've seen so far into that White House. But taking political discussions and putting them onto a server reserved for covert operations that are presidential level is a real good example of how Trump is trying to hide all the bad things he's done.
Yeah. So I'm curious, so far, if you were Rudy Giuliani or Attorney General Barr, how worried would you be about being sucked into this in a way that might be consequential?
Well, they're both going to be sucked into it. In Rudy Giuliani's case, he shot himself in the foot the other day by saying, "I'm not a lawyer here." That means he doesn't have any confidentiality claims at all. I will not be the least bit surprised once we get a new administration if both of these men end up in prison. I mean, let's remember that John Mitchell, who was the attorney general for Richard Nixon, and Kleindienst, one of his other attorney generals, went to prison. And I think Barr here, if the whistleblower complaint stands up, and it seems to be very thoughtfully and carefully written, Barr here may well find himself wearing an orange jumpsuit.
We've talked about other scandals that Donald Trump has been involved in. And the thing is that in this investigation, at least the way Nancy Pelosi is talking about it so far, those are not going to be a part of it. This is going to be very narrowly restrained onto the Ukraine issue. What do you think about that as a strategy?
Well, Pelosi is a real general of strategy, and if that's how she decided she wanted to go, that's what's going to happen because she's pretty firmly in control. This is pretty damaging stuff. I have a piece that just went up a few minutes ago at Raw Story and will be at DC Report on Saturday about how the key to impeaching Donald and convicting him lies with Fox News. There are a lot of Republican senators who would vote on this, who would love to get rid of Donald Trump at this point. Scaramucci told the BBC today, I'm in Hamburg, Germany, which is why I saw this, that he believes about 30 Republican senators would vote to convict Trump on an impeachment if they could cast a secret ballot. So how do you open up the opportunity for the Republicans to leave? Fox News. If Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan tell Sean Hannity to stop what he's doing and change his course, he will. He's an entertainer. The people on Fox and Friends, they're actors posing as journalists who read the scripts that are given to them. And so Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan are in a position here to move all of this. And as soon as one Republican senator comes out in favor of impeachment, others will follow. If you can get two to come out right away, there'll be a very rapid following, and we will see the end of Donald Trump, and the 46th president of the United States will be Mike Pence, who has zero chance, I think, of being elected in 2020.
I think that's a pretty appropriate prediction there on Pence's part. You mentioned that you're in Hamburg. You're currently there for the Global Investigative Journalism Conference. A lot of what we found out over the past few years has been not through whistleblowers like in this case, but through the work of investigative journalists like yourself. But we've also seen Donald Trump's strategies for destroying the credibility of the media, or his attempt to at least, spreading to other regimes. What is the feeling amongst the international community of investigative journalists right now?
Well, interestingly, the whistleblower's report specifies and cites the work of the Organized Crime and Corruption Bureau, which is the biggest investigative newsroom in the world. It's got 150 people scattered all over the country. It's a virtual newsroom. There's an awful lot of discussion here and concern about rising authoritarianism, about countries where we could not hold our next biannual conference because they're authoritarian regimes. But the availability of funding for this conference, the amount, the number of people who've come is way up, and it was way up 2 years ago when we met in Johannesburg. So, I mean, overall, I think on a world level, we are seeing dramatic improvements in investigative reporting. When I started out 50 years ago, you were oddballs in the newsroom. Mm-hmm. So things have gotten much better in that sense, Sean.
One of the greatest developments in this Democratic primary challenge is that there's more and more focus being put on workers' rights, protecting them from exploitation by their employers, by corporations, by politicians as well. And some of those industries are only now getting the respect. The workers are only now getting the respect that they deserve. And earlier this year, a great example of this, I was joined by a journalist for the Daily Beast, Aurora Snow, to talk about state-level efforts to protect adult film performers from exploitation and sexual harassment on their workforce. Let's watch. I very much enjoyed your write-up about this, and you talked about your own personal history of experience at the hands of this sort of pervasive sexual harassment. This bill, based on what you've experienced, do you think that it would do much to protect women working now from that sort of abuse?
Well, I think it's not just about the bill so much that now there's going to be an awareness directly from talent agents. Back when that happened to me, technically, I have a long list of things that count as sexual harassment. But when those things happened to me, I didn't think of it in those terms. And I feel like this generation of performers coming in will start thinking about it in those terms and handling it differently because of this bill.
And in your write-up, you talked not only about the experience of being harassed, but one of the things that was most striking was when you reached out to other people in the industry, your makeup artist, your co-stars, how normalized it actually was. Can you talk about that?
It was incredibly normalized to have a director call me over and have me sit on his lap and grope me and, essentially try to have sex before the scene was something that I was supposed to be flattered about. To have male talent maybe come up to you, lift up your shirt, check you out, slap you on the ass before you're seen. Those types of things are sexual harassment, but it was the norm. And in many cases still is. And so talking about it in context of, hey, I feel like this was misconduct to other talent and the makeup artist on set, nobody looks at it that way. And then suddenly you become the complainer or the person who doesn't quite fit in to the culture.
And so that really like completes the circle of the sexual harassment, hostile work environment, where you, even at a young age, you had a sense that your career could be at risk if you were, like you did raise it as an issue, and unfortunately people didn't have your back. But if you had made a bigger deal out of it, that hypothetically your career could have been severely harmed or perhaps eliminated, correct?
Oh, absolutely. If I had made a big deal out of that, I would have been booked less. I would have been considered difficult to work with. And those aren't the kind of reputations that you want to have a successful career.
And so you talked about how it's not just legislation like the Talent Protections Act, but a change in culture and awareness of what's going on. Over the past few years, we've had simultaneously the Me Too movement. We've also had incredibly powerful people successfully rebuff accusations of sexual harassment and assault, even by dozens of people. To the extent that you know currently, through the course of the years of the Me Too movement, have we seen an evolution inside of the adult film industry in terms of how these actresses are treated and perceived?
We've definitely seen an evolution brought on by the awareness. Now we're having conversations where directors and colleagues, fellow performers are sitting down and having conversations before the scene. And they're talking about things like consent, what's going to happen, what's acceptable. Those conversations weren't happening before. But now we also have this awareness in terms of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. However, there is still an issue with women speaking up on set because they are still dealing with labels like difficult or, hey, she's, you know, you don't want to work with this person because she's going to create problems. When in fact, it's not a problem. It should be okay to address harassment in the workplace.
And there's been a couple, especially in California, because a large portion of the industry is situated here. There have been, over the past few years, a few different sorts of bills, attempts at reform in the industry. And it feels like, you know, I obviously have not worked in the industry. It feels like the people starting these reforms, launching these bills, also have not had any direct, past in the industry. As someone who does know what it's actually like, if you could craft a bill, what do you think could be done that would actually be beneficial and help to protect these performers?
In terms of crafting a bill, I think the best thing to do wouldn't be to just speak to one performer. It would be to speak to a group of performers that span generations. You know, somebody who was in it 10 years ago, somebody who's just entering it now, to get those different perspectives of what's going on in the workplace and what needs to be addressed.
So look, in an attempt to go back and give you an idea of some of the interviews that we've done throughout this year, five is only going to be able to be like the shallowest bit of an idea, because of course we've had literally hundreds of guests throughout this year, some returning over and over to talk about their work, including, you know, Parker Malloy is a great example of that, but Ken Klippenstein, Jordan Ewell, Emma Vigeland, a number of other people. But along the way, we've had activists, politicians, authors, all sorts of people, candidates. And so it's one of the biggest pleasures of doing this show is getting a chance to talk to people who otherwise I simply wouldn't. And hopefully this show was a bit of a reminder of that. Of course, all of our episodes can be found in podcast form and in YouTube and all of that. So you can go back and take a look at some of the great people that we've had a chance to profile and learn from. Hopefully this Thanksgiving has been good for you so far. Like I said, coming up tomorrow on our Black Friday show, we're gonna have a look back on some of our in-depth segments that we've done throughout the year. So anyway, thank you for joining us in this holiday. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.